Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is the Internet a public trust or a center for private profit? Hello again, I'm Warren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Telephone companies and cable operators want to change the way customers pay for the Internet. Instead of the current flat fees, they want different users to pay different amounts, according to how much they go online and how fast they get service. On To the Point, Internet companies and consumer groups are forecasting limits on downloads and email, and the end of virtual democracy. Should governments step in to guarantee access for all, or should free market innovation be left to evolve on its own? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the UN, the Bush White House, and genocide in Darfur. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Google, Yahoo, and other Internet content providers are up in arms because telephone companies and cable operators want to charge extra for high-speed access. On To the Point, would that mean limits on downloads and emails? Is it a threat to virtual democracy, as Internet users have come to know it? On Reporter's Notebook, Kofi Annan asked President Bush for help in Darfur. First, this news update. Vice President Cheney accidentally shot a hunting companion in Texas over the weekend. 78-year-old lawyer Harry Whittington is hospitalized in what's called stable condition. The accident occurred on Saturday, but the White House press corps didn't learn about it for almost 24 hours. Here's the White House press secretary, Scott McClellan.
First of all, Saturday night, I found out that there was a hunting accident. It was late Saturday night, of a member in his party, but I did not know who was involved in that hunting accident. It wasn't until very early Sunday morning that I found out that the vice president was involved in this accident. And of course, in a position like mine, I was urging that that information be made available as quickly as possible. The vice president's office was working to get that information out.
Scott McClellan today at the White House. Ann Kornblut is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And Ann, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
This is unusual that the White House press secretary wouldn't know about this for some, it looks, sounds like 12 or 14 hours after it happened.
Well, I think we all certainly thought so. And I have to say he seemed a little taken aback himself that he had to explain to us that he hadn't known for quite some time. But the reasoning that they have given is that they focused, that the hunting party focused first on getting the shooting victim to the hospital, and then sometime after that, hours later maybe, discussed what they were going to do about it in terms of getting the information public. But yeah, this is a really sort of surprising that the White House spokesperson wouldn't know that the vice president had shot somebody.
The first person to, in fact, reveal it, as I understand it, was Catherine Armstrong, who owns the very large private ranch that they were hunting on. She became a source for a local newspaper. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the story that the White House is giving us now and that she has given is that she, and after the victim had been taken to the hospital, she and Cheney had a conversation and said, well, you know, what should we do about this? And she said, well, I feel comfortable going to the local paper here in Corpus Christi. And Cheney said, okay, that's fine. What's surprising is that normally with things of this importance, they don't leave it to a private citizen to go to the local paper. Normally this would come out of the White House.
You would think it would be a national story if the vice president accidentally shot somebody.
You would think.
What about the incident itself? Is there anything about it that seems to invite scrutiny? Is there any likelihood of there being an investigation by law enforcement authorities?
I think all of that is still being sorted out right now. Nobody from the victim's family on down has suggested there was anything sort of intentional or really unusual about it. I mean, accidents happen, and that seems to be the line from pretty much everyone. But what I think is still being sorted out is what kind of a report would have needed to be filed, if any. There are conflicting accounts about what the legal requirements would be. There's been one account that's unverified, so I shouldn't even say it, but there was a question at the White House briefing about an account that the Secret Service didn't allow the vice president to be interviewed. All this is still up in the air. I don't think we know all the answers yet.
The sheriff, Ramon Salinas III of Kennedy County, is quoted as saying, this was accidental, it was a hunting accident, and what they did was according to law.
Then then that's one part of it. I think we'll probably know more later on today.
Okay. Again, Ann Kornblut is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Is the vice president back in Washington? Is he at his desk?
He is. I can't verify his exact whereabouts at the White House, but he was expected back. He got back last night. The motorcade was followed a little more closely than usual today, and we saw some pictures of him getting out of the motorcade at the White House. So, yeah, he's back there, and the president is. So presumably at some point today they will talk to each other in person.
Everybody has their eye at this point on the news cycle. That would presumably include the vice president's office. Is there anything significant about the timing? One of the things I've seen is that it did obviously mean that the news came out after the Sunday morning talk shows.
Well, we can all speculate about their motives. They are insisting that it had nothing to do with the Sunday shows, and we don't really have much of an option except to take their word for it. But again, I mean, you know, they waited. They aren't naive. They're not new to the news cycles, and no one took any steps on Saturday night to get this out. And, you know, by the time it did come out, the shows were over. So, I mean, it's something I think we're going to hear a lot more about.
Is the vice president known to be good at hunting? They were hunting quail with shotguns, as I understand it.
You know, I don't know. I haven't assessed that. You know, I guess this won't speak well to his record in the long run.
On the other hand, there was some indication, apparently, that Harry Whittington, the man who was shot, in fact, approached the group without telling anybody. He had gone to look for a quail he had shot, as I understand.
That's what Catherine Armstrong, the owner, the woman whose family owns the ranch, told me last night, is that he'd gone off to pick something up and came back and didn't announce his presence. The baffling question, even to the hunters I've spoken to here, is how you couldn't see someone like that coming up, because he wasn't immediately behind him. And he did get sprayed on his face, his neck, his chest, his torso. So it was definitely at sort of, you know, the ground level that he was aiming. But it's still sort of unclear. Maybe at some point the vice president himself will talk about it.
As you indicated, no doubt there will be more about it, whether it comes from the vice president himself or somebody else. As always, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Ann Kornblut, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. In a moment, is the Internet a public trust or a center for private profit? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Allen back with To The Point. Telephone and cable companies invest billions of dollars in the electronic hardware that brings the Internet to consumers. Instead of the flat fees that now apply, they want to charge different amounts to different users depending on how fast they get Internet access. That is not going down well with Google, Yahoo, eBay, and other Internet providers, or with some consumer groups either. Jeffrey Chester is Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. That's a nonprofit consumer advocacy group based in Washington. It's funded by charitable organizations. Jeffrey Chester also writes for the Liberal Nation magazine and has a book coming up, Digital Destiny, New Media, and the Future of Democracy. Jeffrey Chester, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
What are you worried about?
Well, the Internet as we know it is at risk, and I think our whole digital media system is at an important crossroads. This should be a concern not just for consumers and businesses, but for citizens and others who are concerned about the vitality of our democracy. The big cable and telephone companies that now dominate the delivery of high-speed Internet, which is the way most people get Internet, and it's the way that all of us will get Internet in the United States, the big cable and telephone companies have successfully lobbied, and now they have, in essence, a monopoly. They control more than 90% of all broadband access. They want to change the Internet from an open, non-discriminatory network that it was originally conceived as into a private toll road where all of our activities online, including the video programming we get, will be metered and we will be charged accordingly. This includes companies like Verizon, AT&T, Bell South, and Comcast. So everyone will begin to pay more money under their scheme, both users and content providers. And I think this is going to fundamentally change the way that people receive information. It's going to make information unaffordable for many, many people. There already are a number of people in this country, a great many, who cannot even afford the Internet. It's going to make information essential for democratic participation potentially unaffordable. And it's really all about entertainment and video and dollars. Both the cable and the telephone companies want to ensure that they can control the future of the Internet so they can charge us premium rates for the delivery of television. So the debate needs to be much broader than just how we build out this broadband network and even whether or not we treat giants like Google and Amazon fairly. That's why I think we're at an important crossroads. There's no question that the phone and cable companies, because they've lobbied Washington, they now control the future of the Internet, plan to radically change how we receive information. And before they do, we really need to have a national public discussion about what this all means. And frankly, the Internet should not be just another media outlet, which is how it's being conceived. It is a public trust, and we need to have legislation that ensures it remains a public trust.
Jeffrey Chester, once again at the Center for Digital Democracy. We invited AT&T, SBC, Verizon, Yahoo, Google, Amazon, several of the major players in all of this to participate in our program, and they chose not to do so. Adam Thierer is Senior Fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. That's a conservative market-based think tank, which does receive some funding from corporations on both sides of this debate, Google, eBay, the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, and the Telecommunications Industry Association as well. Adam Thierer, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say to the dire warning we just heard from Jeffrey Chester?
Well, you hear a lot of these sort of apocalyptic Chicken Little type complaints or concerns articulated in this debate about the sky about to fall on consumers' heads if we don't do something to regulate the infrastructure we call the Internet. The problem is that there's no harm out there right now, and there's really no reason to believe there's going to be any harm coming to consumers if we allow the Internet to remain free and avoid the sort of government regulation that Mr. Chester is asking for. That's because there's no real reason for carriers, whether they be cable companies, telephone companies, wireless companies, whatever else, the many competitors out there in the broadband marketplace today, there's no reason for them to restrict access to the sorts of services or websites or applications that we desire. Why? Because they're not going to make any money if they do that. It would be suicide for a company to start restricting access to a site like Google or Yahoo or any of the other many popular sites that we have a belief that we're going to continue to have access to in the future. And we will have access to that site and many more sites, hopefully. But the key question for this debate is, do we want to invite the government to come in and start regulating the underlying infrastructure and standards of the Internet in order to prevent a harm that we haven't even seen develop? Again, this is sort of a what you might call a problem in search of a solution or something. I mean, it's a kind of situation where a lot of people are asking for regulation based on hypothetical fears as opposed to real, actual consumer harms. And if those harms were to develop, there's no reason we couldn't use the antitrust laws to address those sorts of concerns as opposed to the sort of preemptive regulation of the Internet that we're talking about here today.
If I may, I think solution in search of a problem is what you were...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I meant to say.
That's okay, I understand. Adam Thierer, again, with the Progress and Freedom Foundation, back to Jeffrey Chester with the Center for Digital Democracy. What about this, a solution in search of a problem?
The problem is, Warren, that in fact what happened was the Internet developed because of regulation. The Internet developed, you know, as an open network because the phone companies that delivered us the dial-up Internet were regulated to be open, non-discriminatory networks. With the backing of Mr. Thierer's organization, what did the cable and phone companies do? They, in essence, regulated the Internet so that they could control the future of the evolution of broadband. They went to the FCC, and they got the FCC in 2002 and recently last year to change the rules so that the phone companies and the cable companies no longer have to, as the original Internet was envisioned, operate as open, non-discriminatory networks. How do we know this is going to happen, where they're going to be charging us all this money? It's not about restricting. It's not about saying you never can go somewhere. It's that the meter is always going to be running, and certain things may become more unaffordable. Certain things are going to cost more. It's going to reduce competition and diversity. As Lawrence Lessig, a professor at Stanford, said, when the college students that created Yahoo and Google, the two most successful online enterprises, wanted to begin their business, they didn't have to go to Comcast. They didn't have to go to Time Warner or AT&T and ask for permission. Under this policy that the phone and cable companies want to implement, they very well might have to. How do we know they're going to do it? the cable industry has a 40-year track record in using its monopoly control of the wire to advance its own programming and to discriminate against its competitors. The phone companies, last week was the 10th anniversary of the 1996 Telecom Act giveaway. The phone companies went to court to undo the principles in that act that required openness. So the phone and cable companies have a bad track record. They have a business model. And I invite everyone, if you have online access, to come to my website, democraticmedia.org, where I've placed on there a number of documents from companies like Cisco and others that are actually building these networks for the phone and cable companies. And it's very clear from the documents what the vision and business model is and why we need to have a national debate and, frankly, should be alarmed about these proposals.
So, Adam Thierer, you say it's a solution in search of a problem. Mr. Chester says the problem is upon us.
Well, I don't see that problem. And again, I don't see where that consumer harm is at. I invite him to give a litany of examples because there are none. The fact of the matter is that people are able to surf and go just about wherever they want today. And if in the future companies decide on their private networks to start charging different prices based on usage, I don't think that's going to be the end of the world. In fact, that's just part of a good evolving business model for any mature economy or industry sector.
Well, wait a minute. Let me get back to Mr. Chester on your first point. What about it? Do you have examples of the kind of limitation that you're talking about and the ultimate restrictions on free exercise of democracy that it seems to me is the most serious of the things you're saying?
There have been incidents, and there are also documents. You can find them on our website and elsewhere, where the cable companies in particular have restricted the ability of users to do a number of things online.
Can you be specific?
They have limited, for example, people operating servers from their homes. The cable industry limited for a time until they were exposed and criticized the cable industry. Because remember, cable is very afraid of having video stream on the internet because that competes with its core programming business. Indeed, the cable industry's internet operation at one time limited the amount of minutes to 15 that you could actually download a streaming video. So there are incidences, but it's very clear now from the business plans. It's when
AT&T. All right, well, those are in the future. But Mr. Thierer, let me give you an opportunity to respond. What about that? Those certainly are real limitations, aren't they?
Well, but those limitations that he's discussing are not cable trying to limit the streaming of video, which even if that was the case, that sort of fear was gone before it even started. Some of the early terms of service agreements that cable companies had out there did have some silly restrictions on things like placing a Wi-Fi network in your home or something. Those are all gone now. And the only types of restrictions that really remain in the contracts we sign with our cable or telephone companies are concerns about things like theft of service. If you're going to put a Wi-Fi network up in your home, fine. But are you going to share that network with everybody in your neighborhood? Not fine. That's something that would probably need to be addressed and that the cable companies should probably take steps to restrict, because that's how they get a substantial stream of their income in order to support the networks that we now rely on.
Should the government do that? Should it support the cable companies and help to make those restrictions?
Well, that's not something you even need additional laws on, because right now you can already sue for theft of service.
All right. Adam Thierer, again, of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. We'll come back to him and Jeffrey Chester as well in a moment. First, here's Gigi Sohn, president and co-founder of Public Knowledge. That's a nonprofit advocacy group. It gets its money primarily from charitable organizations. Ms. Sohn, thank you for being with us.
How you doing, Warren?
Good. What do you say to the debate that we are hearing between Jeffrey Chester and Adam Thierer? You're very much a part of this, too.
Yeah, well, I think there's high rhetoric on both sides, and I think the answer is probably somewhere more in the middle. But let me just address some of the things that my friend Adam Thierer has said, and he is a very articulate spokesman, and he's very, very persuasive. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, first of all, examples. In fact, there are examples today of blocking. Vonage, particularly, the Voice over Internet Protocol telephone provider, has been blocked several times, and there are threats to block.
Hang on a minute.
Well.
What does Voice over Internet providing mean? What does that look like? A lot of people don't know about that.
Yeah, it's Voice over Internet Protocol. In other words, it's just you get your telephone, and instead of having a copper wire like the telephone companies provide or fiber wire, the calls are routed through packets, so they're routed through the internet as opposed to routed through, you know, through Verizon's or Quest telephone.
All right, and Vonage is one of the companies that provides that.
That's right, and they have Jeffrey Citron, their CEO, had testified last week that they've been blocked a number of times, and there are threats to block them. Skype has also been blocked. Now, Skype is also an internet telephone provider. that does a lot of international calling, and they've been blocked a number of times.
Now, blocked in what way and for what purpose?
Well, essentially, the broadband provider has blocked the what they call the port that Vonage service comes in on. So essentially, people that have subscribed to Vonage that also subscribe to a particular broadband provider were not able to get Vonage service.
And is that simply for competitive reasons? They blocked it because they didn't want to have it compete with them?
Well, that's what I would think. I mean, you know, the claims are, you know, that there are bandwidth issues and so on and so forth. But, you know, a lot of the telephone companies particularly see Internet telephony as being a threat to their core, you know, to their core business, their core landline business. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that Vonage and Skype have been blocked. Frankly, if you look at some of the subscriber agreements that some of the telephone companies, particularly Verizon and Quest, have today, they limit a whole raft of legitimate activities, including downloading music and other things, whether it's lawful or not. So those subscriber agreements, they're not all in the past, I'm afraid to say. So, you know, I'm not going to say that there are hundreds of examples, but there are more than enough examples that lead to concern. And that, of course, is coupled with the threats both by Ed Whitaker, who's the CEO of AT&T, and John Thorne, who's a vice president of Verizon, essentially not to let Google and Yahoo have a free lunch anymore.
Okay, back to Adam Thurer. What do you say to those things, particularly the blocking of Vonage?
Well, the blocking of Vonage concern, there's been a lot of allegations about blocking or a lot of people talking a big game about it, but there really hasn't been many major cases of this being brought to the FCC's attention outside of one that was called the Madison River case, which is a very small operator.
What about this one? What about Vonage?
About Vonage? Well, yeah. Most of those I don't think have been substantiated, and we haven't seen clear evidence that this is some sort of a systematic kind of problem across the marketplace. But let me shift gears a little bit and say that even if it was a problem, even if some carriers were playing some games with broadband networks, it wouldn't necessarily be the end of the world. Because after all, we as consumers have a rational expectation, I think a reasonable expectation, to get most of these services delivered as promised or as billed. And if all of a sudden things are being blocked or the signals are being degraded or in some way, shape, or form, I think that provides the greatest impetus of all for other carriers to come and say, we're not going to play these games.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm sorry for that, but we have to take a break in just a few seconds. We'll come back and continue this conversation about the Internet. A little later on Reporter's Notebook, we'll be talking about the United Nations, about the Bush White House, and genocide in Darfur. That became an issue today at the Bush White House. Again, we'll be back with Gigi Sohn of Public Knowledge, Adam Thurer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, Jeffrey Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy. We'll also hear from Christopher Yu, also a professor at Vanderbilt, once clerk for Chief Justice John Roberts. He'll let us know what he thinks about all of this on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today once again about the Internet. One of our guests says that the Internet as we know it is at risk if, in fact, the telephone companies and cable operators are able to charge not a flat rate, but rather charge according to service, according to speed, according to the kind of service that is provided. The contention being that if that happens, there will be many levels of service available according to who can afford what, putting at risk the kind of democracy that we have seen on the Internet as it has developed. Gigi Sohn, again, is president and co-founder of Public Knowledge. A moment ago, Our other guest, Adam Thirer, said that, or perhaps you said, the phone companies and cable operators have said that they don't want to give Google and the other major Internet companies a free lunch. Why should they give them a free lunch? They're spending a lot of money to install the systems, the electronic systems, on which Google and the others rely.
Well, I think you could make the totally opposite argument and say that Verizon and the cable companies' lines are worth nothing unless Google and Yahoo ride on them. I mean, people are going on the Internet to use Google, to use Yahoo, to use MSN. They're not using it to get a Verizon line or a Quest line or an AT&T line. So, you know, why shouldn't Verizon or why shouldn't the cable company pay Google? It all comes down to what we want the future of the Internet to look like. In my mind, the Internet is the most democratizing medium ever. And for the first time, everybody gets a voice. So do we want the Internet to look like a cable system, which is closed, in which the cable operator gets to tell you who gets on, who gets off, at what speed, at what price? Or do we want this to actually be a medium by which everybody can have a voice? I think it should be the former. Now, that being said, I do think, you know, there's nothing wrong with asking a consumer to pay more for more service. So if I have a 10 megabit pipe, I should pay more than the consumer that has a 5 megabit pipe. There's nothing wrong with that. There's also nothing wrong in my mind to ask a provider to pay for extra value-added services a telephone company or a cable company might provide. But you have to, in my mind, you have to require, and the government has to require, Internet providers to provide a basic service with sufficient capacity that, you know, people can communicate and run their applications.
Okay.
Let me just say one thing about what Adam said very quickly. He talks about if your broadband Internet provider blocks or degrades, you can go to another one. Let me just give you a statistic. 58% of the country only has access to two broadband Internet providers. 29% only has access to one, and 19% has access to none. So until there's more competition, you can't just say, well, if you don't like one person's services, you can go to the other. Because right now, both want to discriminate.
All right. Gigi Sohn, again, with public knowledge. Let me go back to our first guest, Jeffrey Chester, with the Center for Digital Democracy. Not on that point, but on the point that it's okay, according to Gigi Sohn, if consumers have to pay more as long as they get better service. Do you object to that?
No, I think what we have to have is a national policy to assure that there is this kind of fast, basic lane that can inexpensively provide the public with access to a broad range of information. The problem is that what's going to happen is that the phone and cable companies are going to be able to send their content the fastest and those that can pay the most the fastest, and that'll become the de facto standard. Nothing else will be able to compete. Also, the overall business model that the phone and cable companies have in mind also needs to be part of the debate. They're talking about making a service that can basically facilitate the needs of entertainment and advertising. According to one of the documents we have on our website from Cisco, and they're building the network for Comcast, the new broadband technology that the cable and phone companies provide will give you, quote, unprecedented insight into the preferences and viewing habits of customers, unquote. So we're also talking about a new massive data collection system to make personalized marketing possible that will also have ramifications about how the Internet evolves.
Okay, Jeffrey Chester, again, at the Center for Digital Democracy, coming to be a more complicated conversation as we go on. As promised before the break, let me introduce Christopher Yu. He's a law professor at Vanderbilt, visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, did in fact clerk for the now Chief Justice John Roberts, and recently completed a study on what's referred to as net neutrality, funded by the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Christopher Yu, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
What do you say to what we just heard, that what's happening here is that the cable and telecommunications operators really want this huge database so that they can determine what people want in terms of entertainment and that they aren't concerned about the democratic issues and free access issues that our other guests are talking about?
I need to clarify one thing. I actually didn't clerk for John Roberts. I clerked for Anthony Kennedy. I worked for John, the Chief Justice, when I was in private practice at Hogan and Hartson.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that.
We're all picky. I just want to make sure I don't want to.
No, I think it's very important. We want to get it right.
Yeah, this is an interesting problem. We hear stories that changing the way the Internet today might hurt consumers, might hurt the ability to innovate on the Internet. And those stories have a certain plausibility under certain circumstances they might happen. What you hear on the other side of the issue is another set of stories, which goes something like this. You know, the way that people use the Internet has changed. You know, it grew up as a way for academics based in universities to communicate with anyone, and then it changed to something that consumers use to send email and web pages. But now it's become something much more than that. We're sending media, we're downloading, we're using internet telephony, streaming video and radio, and it's become a much, much more complicated world. We're not just serving similar customers. What people want out of their network is changing dramatically. And the companies are struggling ways to try to meet that. I'll give you one example. I mean, emails and web pages. If there was a delay of a fraction of a second, a quarter of a third of a second, most of us wouldn't even notice. I mean, an email shows up a third of a second late, it's imperceptible. With the international standards for telephone service, a third of a second delay is unacceptable. I mean, it renders the service unusable to consumers. So all of a sudden we have a world in which small delays didn't matter, change into a world in which small delays matter a lot. What's the solution that some of the networks are proposing to do? Give a higher priority to traffic associated with telephone service and a lower priority, let's say, web pages. Does that violate the kind of neutrality, strictly speaking, between applications? Certain applications are going to run faster. The answer is yes. And so a lot of people are troubled by that. On the other hand, there's these stories about how that might actually enhance the ability, the services provided by the Internet, and might make it possible for there to be more competition in local telephone service. And we have two competing stories. Now, here's the problem. We don't actually know which one is better, which story is going to turn out to be right. And that's just the nature of the economic progress, and there's a lot of people who will tell you this side's going to happen or that side's going to happen, and we have no way to know. Now, the good news is competition policy, as articulated by the Supreme Court of the United States, tells us what to do when there are stories. You can tell stories about how it's going to help consumers and equally plausible stories about how it's going to hurt consumers. The Supreme Court says when you can't tell, wait and let the practice go forward and wait until concrete harm is demonstrated before the government steps in and tries to help. Why? Because economic and technological change needs some breathing room. When we can't figure it out, people need to be able to try things even if there is no guarantee it's going to work. And if we keep them into a one-size-fits-all Internet, the answer is we'll never find out what the other kinds of internets, other structures that we could have had, kinds of internets that we could have had would be. The other reason they say to wait and see what until harm develops is an intense humility about our ability to predict the future of technology. It was just a few years ago that the AOL Time Warner merger came down in 2001, and there was a lot of people very concerned that said this is going to be fundamentally change the internet. Basically, all it was a license for Time Warner to lose a lot of money. And they had a model where they were going to put out an entirely proprietary content world. You live in this walled garden that was America Online, and everyone thought that they were going to be right. Well, it turns out everyone was wrong.
Let me ask you this. Would it be possible hold off, as you're suggesting, from government regulation to see what happens and to see whether harm develops, while at the same time protecting the kinds of concerns that our other guests, Gigi Sohn and Jeffrey Chester, are worried about, access and particularly the democratization that the Internet has been responsible for? Could you do that, or is there a risk that technologies would be installed, investments would be made, and that it might ultimately be too late?
I think that you can try to find ways to protect the other concerns that have been raised. There's two ways that immediately come to mind. You know, they spent some time talking about whether the cable company is going to try to stop you from using your broadband connection to get television in competition with cable, or your telephone company is going to keep DSL from being a competitor to telephone. Well, the interesting problem is telephone companies have some incentive to try to choke off internet telephony On the other hand, they have no incentive to try to choke off streaming video in competition with television. Why? They don't sell television now. It's a new way for them to sell something new, and in fact, they would encourage that. Does that mean that we should put a blanket non-discrimination rule across everything? No, it means that you should target the governmental response to what the scope of the problem is. If telephone companies have an incentive to discriminate against internet telephony, keep them from doing that. But keeping them from barring them from discriminating on the basis of any application, it doesn't seem to make as much sense.
Good for you. Once again, law professor at Vanderbilt, recently having completed a study for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, or funded by them. Gigi Sohn, back to you with public knowledge. What do you say to what we're hearing? Is it premature to regulate now?
Well, I don't think so, and I think Professor Yu has forgotten that both AT&T and Verizon want to provide cable service, and all the big cable companies provide telephone service. So what he said about, you know, limiting discrimination to certain applications in which the broadband provider has an interest in just doesn't work anymore. Let me just address a couple of things that he said. First is, and Adam is very good at sort of mushing up the lay of the land in this area as well, nobody is talking about having a heavy-duty regulatory scheme where every single use of a network is regulated by the FCC. I think the discussion that Adam and I had showed that, yeah, there are differences of opinion as to whether, you know, Vonage is really being blocked or some other applications being degraded. So why shouldn't the FCC have the ability to look at complaints when an application provider, you know, feels that they're being degraded or blocked, or when a consumer believes that they are not getting everything that they paid for? Why shouldn't the FCC, kind of like the Federal Trade Commission, have the authority to look at those complaints and decide whether, in fact, there is some sort of discrimination going on? The other thing that the professor you talked about was prioritizing certain traffic. Well, there may be legitimate network management reasons why you might have to prioritize, say, video traffic over internet telephony traffic over email traffic. I don't think anybody really disputes that. But what we're concerned about, which I think also Jeff Chester is concerned about, is that when, you know, Verizon or AT&T says, okay, well, I'm going to prioritize my internet telephony traffic over Vonage's. So when you're sort of doing inter-class discrimination like that, that's what we're concerned about. We're not necessarily, I'm not going to speak for Jeff.
Why are you concerned about it? What's it liable to result in?
Well, what it's going to result in is, you know, a diminishment of Vonage's ability to compete. We're
okay
for competition. And one thing that Adam talked about is there's no way they're going to discriminate against Yahoo or Google. And he's probably 100% right. But the problem is the Noogle, all right, or the new Yahoo that wants to come down the pike. That's a lot easier to discriminate
okay
against.
Professor Yu, back to you then on this question of why shouldn't the FCC have the authority to look at the complaints and see if things are going wrong?
You know, I think that would be – I would support that, actually. But if, as long as I hear complaints about real-world problems as they develop and they can remediate them looking backwards, okay, we have a problem now, we'll step in and we'll deal with it. What the question really is are we going to act before we have real complaints and set up rules that forbid certain changes to the network happening before we even have a problem demonstrated?
Okay, I understand that. Adam Thierer, let me go back to you with the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Would you, along with Professor Yu, agree that the FCC ought to have that kind of authority?
I think the solution to this is to rely on our competition law or antitrust law principles to govern these sorts of consumer harms as they develop after the fact. We don't want a preemptive, prophylactic form of government regulation for the Internet because, you know, 10 years ago...
Well, wait a minute. Professor Yu said he agreed with that, too. But what about, as Gigi Sohn suggested and as he agreed, giving the FCC the authority to look into complaints, if in fact there are any, as things develop?
Well, of course, the FCC already has some authority like that. What I would not want to see is a system of rules whereby they would be able to go in and essentially preemptively strike at the core of the standards and structure of the Internet as we know it today and freeze it in place. I don't want to necessarily see yesterday's internet be the internet we have for all times and decades to come. I would rather see many internets, many different architectural configurations and infrastructures. What the question that fails to be answered in this debate by the proponents of net neutrality regulation is, how are the innovative new networks of the future going to get funded and built that we deserve?
Okay, question to Jeffrey Chester. What about it?
We need far more extensive safeguards, and we need them now. This is a scam of tremendous proportions, and that's why the phone and cable companies are spending billions of dollars, literally lobbying Washington in a kind of Abramoff of the net.
You have to respond to that question just asked. There are presumably many new services we haven't even conceived of yet, and what Adam Thierer is saying is that if you put in too many regulations, you're going to prevent that from happening.
Well, what you have to do is to make sure that the phone and cable companies cannot favor their own content. You have to make sure that the internet remains open. If we allow business as usual, if we allow the phone and cable companies to continue with their plans, and even if we just say we'll rely on the FCC to file complaints, it's not going to stop this fundamental change of internet architecture that will, by its essence, discriminate against all newcomers. That's at the heart of the plans and the phone and cable companies. And once again, I urge you to come to our website, democraticmedia.org,
okay,
or Free Press or Common Cause. It's very clear what the business plans are, and we better stop them now before we stop innovation, competition, and democratic discourse.
So, Christopher, back to you, our professor at Vanderbilt. Do you buy that one?
Well, I think that there's a real problem, which is we don't know what the future is going to hold. And in fact, you know, everyone assumes that we need to have one internet where everyone can interconnect. Well, you know what? That may be right. It might not be. It could be that what we'll want is sort of several internets that are out there. And instead of wanting a one big network neutrality area, we might want network diversity, which is a vision where it'd be quite different.
Dealing with the issues that Jeffrey Chester mentioned, such as allowing one provider to favor its own content over others, providing then in a situation where customers don't have an ability to choose?
Well, it gets complicated because, I mean, there's some interesting policy arguments, and this has been one of the big changes in the Supreme Court's competition policy over the last several decades, which is the risk of that probably is not as large as it might originally seem. But at any rate, even if it is a real problem, the way you preserve the democratic a different way to preserve the democratic values that Jeff Chester is talking about is to do what we do with phone service, which is if you're worried about people staying connected, you give them essentially vouchers or subsidies and give them people who are on the lowest end of the economic spectrum discounted service.
Okay, very quickly, because I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're very short of time. Gigi Sohn, quickly, does that do the job?
Well, look, an openness principle, a requirement that broadband providers open their networks on a non-discriminatory basis is not time dated. In fact, that ruled the telephone industry for 100 years. It's technology neutral. It will not be dated over time. And antitrust, if I felt confident that this nation's antitrust regulators really would regulate, I might agree with Christopher Yu and Adam Thierer. But unfortunately, they don't do a heck of a lot, so I think you need more than that.
All right. A debate that is really just becoming public, although it has been going on for a long time, obviously, within the industry. And the arguments are well-formulated and very interesting to hear. We'll hear much more of them as time goes on. And thanks to all of you for being with us. Gigi Sohn, co-founder of Public Knowledge, Christopher Yu at Vanderbilt, again, recently completed a study funded by the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Adam Thierer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, conservative group. Jeffrey Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy, writer for the Liberal Nation magazine. His upcoming book, Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy. Thanks very much to all of you for being with us. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan went to the White House today to ask President Bush what America can contribute to stop what the U.S. government officially has called genocide in the Darfur region of Sudan. In a moment, we'll get the background on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The African Union has sent 7,000 soldiers and monitors to Darfur, but the effort is understaffed, underfunded, and apparently ineffective. America's UN ambassador John Bolton has asked the world body to begin contingency planning for a mobile force to end the killings, the rapes, and the pillaging. John Sawyer is former Washington bureau chief for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's now director of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. He has spent the last month in Sudan, a week of that, in the Darfur area. And John Sawyer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us what you saw.
Well, I had an opportunity to travel over most parts of Darfur with the African Union, and the idea was to see what they're doing and the pluses and minuses of the African Union operation. And there are pluses and minuses. On the minus side, as you note, 7,000 people all told. It's way too small for an area the size of Texas, with hardly any roads, as remote and difficult as the environment is there. The communication is very poor. There's one radio frequency for the entire sector of Darfur. They're dependent on contractors for the air movements around the sector of Darfur, and with so few roads, the helicopter movement is essential. And you know, when I was there, they don't even operate on Fridays and Saturdays, the weekend in Sudan, because that's the way the contractors are set up. So if something happens on the weekend, they're hard put to go there. But on the other hand, where they are, in the limited areas where they've reached, they have clearly made a big difference. They're very much appreciated by the people. They've done things like firewood protection patrols and provide security in specific limited areas, and they've helped decrease the number of direct attacks between the government and rebel forces there. So if you talk to people in the region of Darfur, they like the African Union. They'd like to see more of it. They'd like to see more support from the international community so that the force could be bigger and more present in more parts of the country.
In the meantime, how serious are the ongoing abuses? We've heard such heartrending stories about what's going on there with very, very large numbers of people involved. Is it getting any better?
No, I think actually it may be getting a little bit worse in the last 2 or 3 months. And one of the things that's distressing is that the number of attacks that are coming from the rebel side is increasing, and increasingly vicious attacks by the rebel groups. There are two or three main groups on the rebel side. They are each split among themselves. They're fighting with each other. They're fighting with the government, and they're making what seem to be indiscriminate attacks. In the meantime, the attacks by the government and the government-backed militias, these, you know, the Arab militias known as Janjaweed, they've continued as well. And you've seen, you know, something on the order of 50 to 70,000 people just in the past 2 or 3 months who've been displaced, both from their villages and also from some of the displaced persons' camps to which they'd already gone because they've been displaced before. So there's also an overlap. There have been more attacks happening from across the border in Chad. There's concern that the fighting may spread into Chad because you've got, you know, rebel forces backed by groups inside Chad. You've got the government of Sudan interested in destabilizing Chad. So that it's a very dicey situation and delicate. I mean, for a while, last 6 or 8 months ago, I think that there was a sense of things stabilizing, and a number of people, something like 2 million plus, in displaced persons camps, but at least the non-government organizations were able to operate. There was enough security from the African Union that they could get food aid and other health care into the displaced persons camps. And what's happened with this increase in attacks in the last 3 or 4 months is that a number of the NGOs and non-government groups have had to pull out because of security, and so there are areas that are not getting humanitarian aid.
Again, John Sawyer is director of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Well, what's your take on what the UN is asking for, apparently with the at least tacit support of Ambassador Bolton? If there's 7,000 troops there and they have a certain amount of equipment, what could the United States reasonably be expected to provide in addition?
I think that, Warren, what the Secretary General is really looking for is a large commitment in terms of logistical support, better air power, more helicopters, more sophisticated weaponry. I mean, right now, all they really have are pickup trucks and AK-47 automatic rifles and the equivalent. They've got a few armored personnel carriers from Canada that are just now being distributed. I saw a bunch of them. There are like 113 of them that are going out around Darfur, and that will help some. They want more of those, but they're lightly armored, and they're easily attacked if you've got the rocket-propelled grenade, which the rebel groups do have, as do the government. So they'd like to have many more helicopters. They'd like to have support. I think he made a mistake, Kofi Annan did, last week in implying that he was looking for a large commitment of troops from the United States and from NATO. I think that that's not likely to happen politically in this country or in Europe, given the experience that we've had of trying to get European support.
Excuse me for interrupting, but would European troops be acceptable to the people in the region?
That's the other part, is that, I mean, I do think, I was at a demonstration in South Darfur, an anti-United Nations takeover of the African Union demonstration. It was staged by the government. It was one of several in the region while I was there, and yes, it was staged, but there clearly is public sentiment that does not like the idea of Westerners and especially Americans coming in. It's a country that is predominantly Muslim. In Darfur, it's almost 100% Muslim. And the one thing that I think could rally support for a government that is otherwise deeply unpopular is the sense that there is some kind of neo-colonial takeover of people coming, you know, whites and Europeans and Americans coming in to Sudan.
All right. So we will watch then to see what the United States is willing to come up with, as you indicated, in the way of logistics, equipment, and that kind of support. Once again, nothing so far has come out of the meeting at the White House with the President and Kofi Annan. But John Sawyer, you've given us a lot of ways to understand better what happens next. So thanks a lot for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Again, the director of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, former Washington Bureau Chief for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Katie Cooper and Sherman Rembaum. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.